Okay, I'm just going to jump right in. I don't have any fancy theme music for you. I don't have a fancy intro, no song, no nothing. I just like to jump right in. And I'm going to give you your trigger warning now. This topic might not make you happy. It might challenge your beliefs. It might make you upset with me. It's often left as the elephant in the room, but I see elephants in the room, and I address them. I say hello to them. I shake their trunk and say, let's talk. You know, if you want to duck it, now's the time to hit stop and move on. You might have heard me talk about politics on a very simple level on my friend's podcast. Danielle Johnson operates Henny and Hot Wings, where she has a Super Tuesday miniseries called Politics and Ish. And that's just kind of like our 101, our introduction to politics. This is something different. This is not that. This is a little bit more racy. This is a lot more opinionated. It might be a lot more right in your face. It's like 202. You know, it's not super, super geek, but it's not intro level either. We'll say super geek for further down the line, but I wanted to talk about a dangerous intersection. You know, it's where people slow down. Sometimes there's accidents and people crash, and it's not a physical intersection. Well, sometimes it is a physical intersection, but it's mostly a mental intersection. And that is where, in Boston, politics meets race and ethnicity. Are you still there? You didn't turn it off. All right, cool. Well, we'll keep going then. So, you know, Boston's an old city. You know, black people have a long history in it. You know, I'm sure it predates Crispus Attucks, but I want to send a shout out to Crispus Attucks and his descendants anyway. The first man killed in the Revolutionary War, a black man killed by the authorities right in the middle of downtown. I've heard some people say nobody knows who Crispus Attucks is. Let me just help you in case you didn't know. Now you know. But I'm going to speed up history. We're not going to start this out in 1775 or 1776. We're going to talk about freedom in a whole different way. We're going to move up to 1940, 50, and 60. That's the period called the Great Migration. I'm going to touch on a couple of footnotes, but I'm not going to dwell here too long. I'm going to try to keep this short and sweet. This is when black people, and when I say black people, I mean African-Americans. I mean dark-skinned people that were already on this continent before European colonizers arrived, and also the descendants of those that were from West Africa that arrived here on slave ships and were sold into bondage. In the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, there's a period called the Great Migration. You probably didn't read about it if you're a Boston Public School student in your history books, because the history books are fucked up like that and don't really tell our history. They tell his history. And this is when black people were moving out of the South to escape what remained of Jim Crow and racism and discrimination. Not that they wouldn't find it up north, but they thought it would be a little bit softer up north and out west. So you saw people moving from south of the Mason-Dixon line into what became, you know, sort of black meccas here in America, towns like Oakland, California, Chicago, Illinois, Harlem, New York, Boston, Massachusetts. Boston, Massachusetts didn't quite, because it's so small, doesn't quite meet the level, but you see where I'm going with it. So here we are in Boston, and believe me, there's black people making moves. I remember meeting with some of the elder Guskets, may they rest in heaven or in peace, depending on your beliefs. And they were telling me about getting into the real estate game in 1955 and buying property in Grove Hall with 5 or 10 of their buddies. This is a lesson that I wish more of us took and heard and understood, because it impacts us today and how wealth is built. But I digress. I just wanted to send a shout out to the Guskets. During this migration, all bankers were white. During some of this migration, we don't even have the right to vote. And there's this thing called redlining that both city planners as well as bankers participated in. And redlining is just a fancy term for creating ghettos. Ghettos are created. Now, I'll acknowledge that some people do migrate based on shared cultures and traditions and languages. But usually that's afforded to white people. It's not always afforded to people of color, black people, or any other groups of color, whether that's Asian, whether that is Latino. They're usually forced into the ghettos or nearby ghettos that blacks have been in for decades, if not, you know, hundreds of years. So in Boston, everybody knows what the ghetto is, right? You know, it's Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan. It's the same ghettos that Malcolm X lived in. It's the same ghettos that Martin Luther King went to home after he went to school at BU in. They're the same ghettos now. They have the same disparities with higher increases, higher disparities about health, life, longevity, violence, economics, unemployment, you name it. The ghettos have remained the same because, for the most part, we've been operating the same way politically and financially. If you think about Boston's leadership since that time, with the exception of Mayor Menino, they've all been white mayors, but with the exception of Mayor Menino, they've probably all been white Irish mayors. And you can feel free to leave a comment and correct me if I'm wrong, but I doubt it. So let's talk about migration patterns. White people migrated as well. They immigrated and migrated. Early in Boston and other places in America, Irish weren't always looked on kindly, and neither were the Italians. And they had their own migration patterns. You know, if you're looking for the white Irish neighborhoods in Boston, you know where they are. If you're a Bostonian, you know they're in South Boston. You know they're in West Roxbury. You know they're in the south side of Dorchester. You know they're in... So let me get back to the redlining, right? Because these ghettos are created... You know that in Boston, without there being a highway or railroad, because sometimes they use, you know, city planners use stuff like that to separate black people from white people or poor people from wealthy people. If you're going from Columbia Road to Ashmont, you're going up Dorchester Ave, Columbia Road and Ashmont, you know to the right side of Dorchester Ave is the ghetto. It's where black people live and Latinos and Caribbean Americans and some Vietnamese as well. To the left side of Dorchester Ave is where white Irish people live for the most part. That's by design. It's not by accident. Ghettos are created. Same thing once you pass Tremont Street. Now, mind you, black people did used to live in Beacon Hill and in the South End, which was Lower Roxbury. But you know now once you pass a certain line on Tremont, you have left the ghetto and you've entered a more affluent white neighborhood. So I say that because politics falls along those lines as well. People self-identify. If you're looking for Italian Americans in Boston, you think about the North End first, and then you think about East Boston, right? Language, race, ethnicity, cultures, foods, you name it. These are the things that bring people together, keep people together, and sometimes keep people apart. Now, I was lucky enough as a black man of Latino descent to have been started in civic engagement by my father. But my political start happened in the office of Michael Flaherty. Now, my political start was probably a result of Counselor Chuck Turner chastising the at-large counselors who represented the whole city for not having any people of color on their staff. So in response to that, at-large counselors then started hiring people of color, me being one of them. I was a quick learner watching Michael Flaherty and other people from South Boston basically politic for their neighborhood. I was impressed. I was impressed that a group of men and women who didn't always agree could fight like cats and dogs at times, call each other names, but when it came time to step forward publicly for the community, could put their differences aside and move as one to make sure that the tribe rose higher. And this had been going on long before I worked there. This had been going on for decades and decades, right? Long before Flaherty was in office. Once white Irish men started getting power politically and financially, they looked out for their tribe. They started to fill up good jobs in the city. They started to fill up the police department, the fire department, at the state level, the MBTA, you name it. And the trickle-down effect is that now you're gainfully employed, you're able to buy houses, you're able to buy property, you're able to send your kids through college, their education gets better, they're able to come back to these neighborhoods and buy property and houses, and you're building wealth, generational wealth, and you're passing it down, and you're helping support elected officials who made this possible, and it becomes a cycle. A positive cycle that benefits the neighborhood. So I said to myself, wow, we need to be doing this in my neighborhood because my neighborhood has all these disparities. This is a dope model. This is how politics works. So me, as a black man of Latino descent, I decide after a couple years, I'm going to run for office. Now, I don't want to make that race intersection just a black and white thing, because I remember when I first ran in 2007, a friend of mine who I went to school with, who was a supporter of mine, she told me a story about telling her mother, who was African-American, they're both African-American women, told her mother to vote for me. And she said, yeah, I told my mother to vote for you. I said, look, we're on the ballot, vote for Carlos Henriquez. And her response was, I'm not voting for no fucking Puerto Rican. And I said, damn, that's what she said? She said, yeah, man. I said, but I'm not even Puerto Rican. But I say that to say that ethnicity and race intersect sometimes in negative ways. And it's not just black and white. Sometimes it's black and brown. Sometimes it's within black. Sometimes it's within brown. You know, there's all these different issues. But what I want to go back to is the fact that if we're smart and if we're strategic, and if we believe that we need somebody from our community who understands our community, who is courageous enough to, and smart enough to represent our community, then if we support them, the tribe rises. Those of us with commonalities, those of us that have kids in public schools that are poor performing, whether they're Latino or African-American or Vietnamese, then we do better together, right? There's political power together. Those resources are going to have to come from somewhere. And there's going to be resistance. So we need to band together to quote unquote fight those battles. Now, let me digress away from all the history and all the race talk and apply this to local politics. After the preliminary election, like after every election, the political super geeks get together. We start to call each other on the phone. Sometimes we do it one-on-one. Sometimes we do it in small meetings. Sometimes we're standing around the water coolers in places. And we start to look at the numbers. And we don't just look at like who won, who came in first, second, or third, like it's a race. We start to look at maps and where the votes came from. And we break it down precinct by precinct. And you see voting patterns. And you see these same patterns I just spoke about in terms of tribal patterns. Tribal enclaves, tribal neighborhoods that are alike, that are homogeneous in terms of they all look the same. They vote similarly, right? Let me give you an example. White Irish neighborhoods know, and it's historically they support white Irish elected officials. So when there's a vote, if your last name is Flaherty or Murphy, which is the last name of two of the top eight finishers, your strongest support comes from those neighborhoods. This bears true. You can't even really argue this. If you have a map and you know the numbers, you'll know that Michael Flaherty and Erin Murphy, now they're two different political monsters, right? Michael Flaherty has run for mayor. He's almost a household name. He's been on the city council for probably like 14 years, 16 years total. And Erin Murphy never has run for political office before. But because of their surnames, they get support in the same neighborhoods. South Boston, South Dorchester, West Roxbury, and a couple other pockets of the city that are known to be conservative or very supportive of white Irish people. You look at a Michelle Wu, who's kind of, well, first she's a transplant. She's not native, right? But I'm not holding that against her. She's from Chicago. Some hold it against her. But we got some good leadership from Chicago. Deval Patrick, Ayanna Pressley. You know, there must be a connection between Chicago and Boston. We have to get into that later. But Michelle Wu, she gained her, she topped the ticket, right, in the preliminary, and she got support from all over the city. She got the broadest base of support. So she did well in every single neighborhood. She wasn't strong, super strong in some neighborhoods and super weak in others. Whereas, you know, a Michael Flaherty or Erin Murphy were super strong in some neighborhoods and then super weak in some others. The same thing, the inverse is true. Actually, the same is very similar for Anissa Asabi George. She did well. Now, she identifies herself as a woman of color, and she did well in certain neighborhoods, but very similar to Michael and Erin Murphy. But then she did a little bit better in communities of color. You know, some people view her stances as a little bit more progressive. I'm not sure if I agree with that. You know, you can figure that out for yourself. But she did a little bit better in certain other neighborhoods like Jamaica Plain, the South End. And that could be for a couple of different reasons. Alejandra St. Guillen, Julia Mejia, Althea Garrison, and David Halbert did well in communities of color. Even though there was a low voter turnout in communities of color, And before everybody, you know, jumps off the bridge and starts shaming their fellow black people and fellow Latinos, let's remember that for a long time, we didn't even have the right to vote, right? These folks have been voting for generations. We have been voting for maybe three, four if you stretch it, but really like three. So, and we haven't had the same return on investment as these other neighborhoods. We haven't been able to fill up a police force. We haven't been able to fill up a fire department. We haven't been able to fill up an MBTA for two or three generations to get our return on investment for voting. So everybody ain't gassed on the idea yet, and I understand that. So shame them if you want. I'd rather you engage them, teach them, and show them the way. But, you know, you do you. So I say that to say, identity politics matters. Now, some people like it. I think it's just a reality. Some people don't like it. You know, some congressmen don't like it when they get their ass kicked by someone that they don't think should be able to beat them. But it happens like that. I know that when my name was on the ballot in Cape Verdean communities and Latino communities, I was going to do better just on name recognition because they know they have a Carlos in their family. They have an uncle, they have a nephew, they have a son named Carlos. You know, whether it was in Eggleston Square precincts where the large Latino population, whether it was in Ward 8, you know, 5, 6, and 7 in the Cape Verdean community in Roxbury, Dorchester, they recognize the name, and some people just come out and support a name that's familiar to them. Because not everybody is a political super geek or a wonk or you name it. So let me try to bring it back full circle. There are limited resources in our budget every year, $3.2 billion. And not everybody that sits on the city council is speaking about bringing those resources to the communities that I live in, the communities that you may live in, to do the things that we think need to be done. What are these things, you might say? Some of these things that the city councils are responsible for are keeping needles out of our parks in the South End, in Roxbury, in Dorchester, and even people are talking about it in Mattapan, the opioid crisis. A lot of these sitting in city councilors and candidates, I've never heard talk about reducing gun violence or violence period in communities of color. I haven't heard them talk about community health, supporting community health centers. I haven't heard them talk about year-round jobs for kids that come from economically impoverished communities. I haven't heard them talk about improving lessening the amount of poor performing schools that are concentrated in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan. I just haven't heard them talk about it. So there's no need for me to believe that it's going to happen now because there's a new election and because they printed it on an expensive flyer. I just don't believe it. I've lived under mayors who've had strong mayorships and city councilors that went along with it. I've lived under I've never had a black mayor, not saying a black mayor would fix everything, but I've never lived under a black mayor. I've never lived under a city council that wasn't dominated by white men or dominated by men. And November 5th offers a unique opportunity to create a city council that reflects the diversity of the city of Boston. We have the opportunity to send not just one first, but you can actually double down on first if you're into that kind of thing, making history. You could send two Latinas to the Boston City Council. Now, we've had two Latinos, so it won't be the first time, you know, a person of Latin descent sits on the city council. We had Felix D. Arroyo, the father, and Felix G. Arroyo, the son, not Junior. Don't get it twisted. But we could send two Latinas, Julia Mejia and Alejandra St. Guillen. I mentioned the two of them, and I say we because I believe that their platform speaks to, and their work that I've seen them do, speaks to my issues and the issues of my community. I have worked with both of them on certain issues. I have politicked with both of them on certain issues. I have worked on campaigns with both of them for other candidates. In that, there's another first. Alejandra St. Guillen identifies as openly gay, and she could be the first openly gay woman sitting on the city council. If you're into making history, there's another plus for you. Althea Garrison Althea Garrison is so much of an anomaly for me. I run against Althea, oh my gosh, probably four times in my life. Her politics is very interesting. I don't believe that all of it speaks to my neighborhood. I believe in her constituent services, right? I can't knock her on constituent services. There are women and residents in this community who love her because she spends the time talking and she works with them to make sure that things are done. The things that I was talking about, like parks renovated and clean, crosswalks done, ramps made accessible for people with disabilities, she does that part of it. Some of her other politics, I'll leave that to you. And David Halbert. David Halbert is a man that used to work for Councilor Sam Yoon the same time I used to work for Councilor Flaherty. He knows policy. He's lived in East Boston. He now lives in Mattapan. I believe in a lot of his vision. He finished eighth, and most people would say, well, he's so far out of position that he can't grab a seat. That's not true. You know, now they won't say it, and people don't like to talk about it, but there's slates. Slates is when, you know, a group of people are running together on one team, right? So the last slate you really heard a lot about was Team Unity, you know, and that ruffled some feathers. And you know why? Because people didn't want to share the power or see a power block emerge. We'll get into that as a whole nother episode. But there's also been, you know, I believe Michelle Wu and Alejandra St. Guillen, as well as Kim Janey, have campaigned together, shared resources, shared an office. Did I mention Suffolk DA Rachel Rollins is one of the first? I just want to make sure. If I didn't, I would be remiss. Shout out to Rachel. But they've campaigned together as sort of a slate. So I'm pitching the idea of a community slate, those that I believe can represent my community. You could vote for, this is just a possibility, right? You could vote for David Halbert, Alejandra St. Guillen, Julia Mejia, and Michelle Wu. You have up to four votes for at-large. You could vote for the four of them. And if you voted for the four of them in good numbers, all four of them could be seated on the Boston City Council. You would have, for the first time ever, probably a majority-minority, even though I hate that oxymoron term, a majority-minority city council, the most diverse city council Boston has ever had, that is the most reflective of the population of Boston. Let me say that again. If you were to take your four at-large votes and vote for David Halbert, Julia Mejia, Alejandra St. Guillen, and Michelle Wu, you could deeply not only diversify the council in the way it looks, but in my opinion, elect strong advocates, strong leaders on issues that cross the entire city of Boston, that are not just germane to certain pockets based on political power coming from one, two, or three neighborhoods. That's just an idea. I just want to throw it out there, because based on the voting patterns, there's a lot of room to grow for the candidates that I just named. There's less room to grow for the candidates that I didn't name. You know, like, it's going to be tough for Michael to pick up more votes in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan than he already got. It just probably ain't going to happen. Erin Murphy, same thing. I don't think she's knocking doors in Ward 12, 14, 17. And for the newbies that might have tuned in, that's Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan. I don't think she has volunteers knocking doors in 12, 14, or 17. So I'm not mad at her for that. That's a strategy thing for her. She's decided that she has a limited amount of resources. She has to use them in the neighborhoods where she thinks she's going to get the most bang for her buck. If she feels like that's not Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, cool. Then you probably can't represent me in Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury. Therefore, I probably won't vote for you in Roxbury, Dorchester, or Mattapan. So I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to keep this under a half hour. I thought I was going to go on a long rant and get into some of that. That's really where I see it intersect. And like I said, we've tried it the other way. And I think people want real change. And I'm not guaranteeing it. I'm not one of these candidates. I've run for office before. I've organized electeds of color. There's actually 12 electeds of color sitting in public office right now. I'm actually often I'm usually pissed with them because they don't stand united on any issue. They are not very vocal on any issue. So I'm not even guaranteeing that if you, but they're a mix. They're not all from one body, right? There's state reps, there's district attorney, there's sheriff, there's state senators, and there's city councilors. I still expect them, based on the work that came before my election. I was basically just reinventing or recopying the Black Political Task Force. And I convened, when I was a state rep, I convened this body of self-identifying people of color to deal with the issues of their residents, because their residents are mostly people of color. Therefore, there's commonalities in that tribe. There's large disparities, there's disparate treatment of the people that they represent. So I thought it, learning from Councilor Flaherty's office, we could apply this to our communities and raise that tide and float all these boats. It hasn't happened the way that was derailed. And some of you might know the story on how it was derailed and some of you don't. But I haven't seen that energy continued, right? And we'll talk about that another time too. But I do believe if you could change entire body, you could diversify a body like the Boston City Council, you definitely have the potential to see a stronger check and balance on what the mayor, whether it's Mayor Walsh or his successor or somebody else down the road, you set it on a track where it's more reflective of the ideas, the look, and the population of the city of Boston. And for those that believe that representation matters and that identity matters and cultures and traditions matter, it's just an idea for you to think about. You don't have to buy it. Maybe you want to rent it for a day or two, bounce it off your people in the barbershop, bounce it off your friends, bounce it off your campaign team. Some of these campaigns are probably thinking, we're running against each other. There's only 4 seats. I got to knock you off. Not necessarily. You don't got to announce a slate, but you can make a phone call. You can help each other out. You can share events and say, hey, I'm going to be over here. Let's go knocking doors over here. Let's present this way. Huh? No? Yeah? I mean, just think about it. I just want to throw that out there. I throw that out there and I want to throw a shot. I won't call any names, but I had an interesting conversation today about this with a former colleague of mine, he's a political super geek like myself. And we chatted up for a little while about that, about the way this race could go. So I wanted to share that idea. The candidates won't say it because people are so sensitive these days, they might get offended. But I mean, if incumbents are partnering up with challengers, then, anything goes, because there used to be a rule where the incumbents weren't supposed to do that. The unwritten rule, right? Don't be running anybody against us, which is, I thought, was a bullshit rule anyway. So form your allegiance, build it on commonalities, build it for win, and build it for the people. And the people do the same thing. Vote for people that is in your best interest. Don't go in there November 5th and just circle names that you know because you heard them before. Circle the names that are going to represent you, that you feel are going to represent you to the best of their ability. Speak to your issues, act to your issues, and try to get results. That's all. I don't have no fancy outro either. If I had theme music, I would have queued it up already. I appreciate you listening. If you got any comments, concerns, you can leave a comment on this on the website, stillreppin.com, or you can email me directly. If you want to debate on air, we can do that too. If I like you, or if I don't like you not too much, I can dislike you. But if I dislike you too much, we ain't going to talk. Los@stillreppin.com is the email. We got 4 more weeks. Let's get out the vote. Let's improve our city one way or another. And to the candidates, may the best women and other candidates help diversify this race and this body we call the Boston City Council. Peace.